You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 12th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, from Beijing and Pyongyang to Tehran and Jakarta, we'll review the top stories with John Everard and Kathleen Burke here in the studio. Then, Dickon Bewes discusses his latest book, Slow Train to Switzerland, and tells us how the Alpine nation changed the face of tourism.
No one who was a doctor or a lawyer and only had 3 weeks off a year could contemplate going to Switzerland. What changed was Thomas Cook made use of the trains, which meant 2 days to Switzerland instead of 2 weeks, and negotiated group tickets.
All that, plus music, a bit of Spanish sherry, and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So lots coming up here in the next hour on Aperitivo. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Four days on from the Philippines' devastating typhoon, survivors in the worst-hit areas are still waiting for food, shelter and clean water. Roads and communications have been badly damaged, making it hard to reach many people. And with sanitation systems widely destroyed, sewage is now contaminating water supplies. Adrian Edwards, who speaks for the UNHCR, says many are facing an unimaginable crisis.
The current situation puts the most vulnerable people at very significant risk. Women and children begging on the streets for donations, exposing themselves to abuse and possible exploitation. With power lines still down, the lack of lighting has made children and women home and in evacuation centres more vulnerable, especially at night.
At least 10,000 people are known to have died, but around 11 million have been affected by the typhoon. Tarek Jaselevic is from the World Health Organization.
The priority is to establish temporary medical centers as health needs are significant. As you can imagine, there are people who sustained injuries, trauma, but also there are people with irregular health needs. And just to give you an example, it's expected that 12,000 babies will be born in the next month in the affected area.
Egypt's government has lifted a state of emergency and a curfew 3 months after they were imposed. Thousands of supporters of the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, have been detained by authorities since the emergency powers were brought in. The move to end them came 2 days earlier than expected following a court ruling. China's leaders have announced a series of economic reforms designed to boost the country's global standing. They've promised to open access to international markets and give farmers more direct rights over their land. The proposals follow a summit in Beijing, but Communist Party officials say that state ownership will remain a key factor in the Chinese economy. EU leaders have been meeting to discuss ways to tackle youth unemployment. Across the Union, it's thought 19 million young people are without work or training. In Spain and Greece, youth unemployment rates are close to 60%. A summit earlier this year agreed to spend at least 6 billion euros over the next 2 years trying to address the problem. India's Supreme Court has set up a panel to investigate claims that a law student was sexually harassed by a recently retired judge on the court. The woman made the claims in a blog published last week. She says the judge assaulted her in a hotel room in Delhi last December when she was working for him as an intern. Afghanistan's government has burned more than 20 tons of illegal drugs on the outskirts of the capital, Kabul. Opium and heroin was included in the haul, destroyed in a public display. But Jean-Luc Lemieux, who's the head of the UN's anti-drug agency in Afghanistan, warns there's only been limited progress.
Despite this tangible progress within the world of the narcotics, the addiction rates are still going up far beyond 1 million. And for the third consecutive year in a row, we witness an increase in opium cultivation. Those elements are very worrying.
A senior UN official has criticized both government and rebel groups in Sudan, who he says are blocking efforts to vaccinate 165,000 children against polio. John King says both sides should give health workers access to children in two Sudanese states. The country has been free of polio for the last 2 years, but officials are worried there could be an outbreak in the two southern states. Sir John Taverner, one of the leading British composers of the 20th and 21st centuries, has died at the age of 69. Much of his music drew on spirituality. In 1999, he wrote a piece which was chosen to see in the new century at the Millennium Dome in London. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich, London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle 26.
From London.
London, Canada.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is now 18:06 and 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at the University College London. Welcome both to the programme. Obviously, the news that's been dominating all day is what's been happening in the Philippines, and the still kind of unfolding. We don't know obviously how many people have died, and even I see the numbers for the number of people displaced from their homes ranges from the hundreds of thousands to maybe 3 million people. At this point, John, when you watch what's happening, do you think that we've learned a lot from, unfortunately, very recent episodes, obviously in Japan and then the Asian tsunami, that we're actually more effective at responding to these things? Because there's, again, been criticism of some slowness, but do you think that's misplaced?
Well, yes, I think that everybody would agree that it would be better to react faster, but we are reacting much faster and much more effectively than we did in the past. Yes, we have learned a lot of lessons. There are systems in many countries now for instant deployment teams. People get texts and just rush to an airport effectively and get straight into the disaster area. I think the other big lesson we've learned is that for all our progress, for all we've achieved as a species, just how vulnerable we are to nature. I mean, that no amount of relief effort is going to solve the problems of a typhoon ripping through a major city like this.
Kathleen.
Well, of course, you can send all the aid you want to send, but if it can't be received, it's a real problem. I mean, the airports are destroyed. What roads there were are pretty well destroyed. So there's masses of aid going toward at great speed, but then it's just stopping by a broken bridge or an airport you can't get to or whatever. So what we have learned as well is that no matter how technologically well organized we are, we're at the mercy of nature.
And in an instance like this, we see that, you know, many nations are sending in, you know their military teams. They've got, you know, we've got the UK has warships are going to be off the coast. Practically, you know, if you send a ship in like that, what can they do? Are they providing medical resources, or are they just kind of offloading things that they happen to have on board? What's the purpose of that? Is it a show of, you know, more show rather than a kind of an active participation?
No, it's more than just a show. They will have stores on board. Ships carry emergency supplies, which they'll be able to distribute to, you know, to the local population. Some of these ships also carry helicopters. And in this kind of situation, helicopters are of vital importance. Kathy was quite right just now to point to the difficulties of actually moving the aid from the coastal areas inland where it's most needed. And helicopters are very, very effective at that.
And Kathleen, if you're sitting in the presidential palace in Manila and you're watching this unfold, how quickly do you think you need to respond, and how well do you need to be a public figure at this time? You know, President Aquino is popular and has done many interesting things, but we've seen in other instances where leaders have not been seen to be effective. Actually, when it comes around to election time, they were very quickly gone. We're seeing that in Chile at the moment. You know, there's a president who was amazing during the miners' tragedy. But then suddenly, you know, he's being booted out.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, leaders can say, do this, do this, do this, but the systems aren't in place. Nothing will actually happen. With the best will in the world, I have some sympathy with leaders in a situation like that, just because because of the nature of the system, because of the nature of the background, because there are other difficulties, because the Philippines had an earthquake just 4 weeks ago, and so forth and so on. They were already strained. And now as far as I can tell, he's doing the best he can, but there's very little one person can do.
Well, let's move on to a very different story. We've been looking over the past few days at what's been happening with Iran and the talks, you know, the will they won't they talks. You know, that we've had a slight breakthrough today with an agreement with the IAEA about allowing in inspectors into Iran to look at nuclear facilities there. But it's still very unclear what really happened at the end, and lots of kind of intrigue. You know, was it the Saudis? Was it Israel putting pressure on France? You know, who buckled first? Kerry seems to imply that, in fact, it was Iran. John, you've been close to lots of these events and you know what unfolds. What's your reading?
My reading is that it doesn't really matter. Unless these talks were very heavily pre-cooked, there was no way that from a standing start you were going to reach an agreement in 3 days flat. There are going to be round after round after round. The kaleidoscope will be spun again and again. Different obstacles will come up. Different obstacles will be solved. The key point is that they are talking and that everybody agrees that they've made much more progress than they ever thought they would. And that people seem to be quite optimistic that at the end of this process, which may take some time, got to be patient, that an agreement is within reach. That's what really matters.
Do you agree, Kathleen? I wondered if it was a bit like one of those kind of, you know, you go out on a date with somebody, things moved a bit too fast in the relationship, and then suddenly everyone kind of wakes up and thinks, oh, we need a kind of cooling off moment. Because the French do seem to have had some legitimate points, you know, that there was just too much of a rush towards an agreement, and actually a period of contemplation was needed as well in the midst of all this. Do you think that's fair?
Well, it's rather like a father coming in and separating the teenagers who were getting quite carried away, I suppose. Yes, I think France did a very good thing. I mean, the Americans didn't like it much because it broke what they saw as the momentum, but I agree with John entirely that momentum, but careful momentum, is very good. But he's quite right. It's going to go round and round and around because everyone's going to have to give up something. And at this point, it doesn't appear to be in any country's firm ideas just what they're willing to give up. They're all going to hold out for what they can get. It should be quite interesting to watch the whole process.
Catherine, do you think if there is an agreement that America is going to lose some friends? Because, you know, the Saudis, whatever happens, are not going to be happy if there's, you know, an agreement with Iran. And I doubt that many other kind of players in the region, certainly Israel, is not going to be delighted if there's a settlement with Iran. Do you think America's got to face, you know, a bit of a kind of tough moment ahead?
Well, America's had an awful lot of tough moments. It's the problem of, you know, any sort of leadership is that everyone's going to hate you at some point. The good thing is that most of them can't do without America, and as the push comes to shove, that will probably help facilitate some sort of agreement. I mean, the one that's really going to be difficult, for obvious reasons, is Israel. And that's the danger point, because they have threatened to bomb the Arak reactor if arrangements aren't come to that they feel secures their safety.
Obviously, the Arak reactor, John, was one of the sticking points for France. But it is fascinating if we look, you know, just back 18 months, 2 years. Here we were in a situation where every day we had stories, you know, is Israel going to bomb Iran?
Yes.
And the people who argue, you know, the doves, as it were, who argue that that would be the wrong move, they must feel vindicated now, mustn't they?
No, I don't think they do at all. I think that the Israelis, they feel glad that the agreement didn't actually get signed on the day. But I suspect that as this process moves forward and it becomes clear that a deal is achievable, that the hawks in Israel are going to feel quite isolated, that those in Israel, and there are many of them, who believe that a deal with Iran is a good thing, something to bring Iran back into the tent, they're the ones going to feel vindicated.
Now, Kerry has said that in the last 30 days, more has been talked about than in the last 30 years. And we've certainly seen in the election of Rouhani an Iranian president who seems more able to do a deal and more willing to do a deal. But a blunt question, do you think we can believe him?
Yes. I think that Rouhani is straight. I think he's under immense domestic pressure. He's going to have to present anything he works on with the foreigners very carefully to a sceptical and deeply conservative leadership. But my take is that this guy is actually looking for a deal, and that if we're going to do a deal with Iran, then it's going to be with him.
And Kathleen, if a deal happens, is it because Tehran is broke or because it actually was never intending to build nuclear weapons in the first place?
Well, I tend to feel that countries do what they can get away with, whether for good or for ill. And I think that they would have continued trying to build nuclear weapons if possible, just because there is such a division in the country in that sense. The fact that they don't have the money to do it right now is crucial, or in many respects to buy enough medicines and enough of the other sorts of supplies which people need, and they can't get money in and out through the banks, which is quite crucial.
So in the end, the sanctions in this instance have paid off?
I think so, absolutely. You have a choice, don't you, when it comes conflict. You can either shoot people or you can try to constrain what they can do to satisfy their bodily needs. And it's at least constraining bodily needs takes an awful lot longer than just shooting someone. And a lot can happen when you've got a lot of time.
And John, you wanted to add something?
Yes, I want to say here that the economy is at the heart of all this. The leadership, it's not just a question of paying for the nuclear program, though that's important too, but they know they have to do something about the economy to prevent popular discontent welling up. And they know that to do that, they have to find some way of getting some of the sanctions removed. Just a week ago, we were looking at the anniversary of the seizure of the American hostages in Iran, this huge upsurge of popular feeling in favor of the Iranian revolution and young people really wanting to take it seriously, to throw the foreigners out. That was quite a thought. I mean, I just don't see that ever happening in Iran now. The revolution has gone very, very stale. People are fed up and the leadership know they're in trouble.
Oh, fascinating stuff. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, and I'm here with John Everard and Kathleen Burke. When we return, we'll look at one of the biggest stories from China. We'll also be heading to Thailand and North Korea. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain. But over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
For the November issue of Monocle, we head north, to the high north no less, for a special Arctic-themed edition. We set sail on icebreakers and Alaskan ferries, take a look at Nuuk, a gander at Gander, and meet a certain man in red who's gearing up for his busiest day of the year. And there's lots more too.
In the affairs section, I meet the cardigan-clad foreign ministers of the Arctic Council as they do diplomacy, Arctic casual style. We look at Greenland's fight for independence, and we see how Santa Claus is flying the soft power flag for Finland.
In the business section, we head to Helsinki to meet a company that designs and tests the toughest ships on the high seas, icebreakers. And we find out how the thawing north may be a boon for Finnish yards who make icebreakers. And we head to Burma to see how a new cadre of entrepreneurs is descending on Yangon to open restaurants, bars and boutiques.
So don your goose down for Monocle's special Arctic report. The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how to join the club. You'll feel on top of the world.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Still with me is John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. Let's move to Asia now, where a few stories have caught our eye from China to Thailand and North Korea. But let's start in Beijing, where Chinese Communist Party leaders have just announced a series of economic reforms at the so-called Third Plenum. John, I know this is one that you've been following, and I've tried to kind of read what's come out of this meeting. For the person who doesn't know how to read Chinese politics, it looks mighty kind of generalist and slightly, you know, we're going to do better, we're going to make the economy better, we're going to let the market work. Behind all these kind of like slightly bland statements, is there some nitty-gritty being decided here?
Yes, there's a lot of nitty-gritty. And the communique that's come out of this plenum really is a biggie. I mean, the changes that they have announced are serious. The third plenum for any Chinese government is always the moment where you announce effectively your government program. That was when Deng Xiaoping announced the first set of reforms, where Zhu Rongji announced the beginning of the social market economy. And now Xi Jinping has followed suit, announcing a blockbuster range of reforms. Whether he can actually get all these through, and there will be stiff opposition at a lot of levels, we'll have to see. But the blueprint's out there. And like I say, it's big, it's ambitious, and it's very bold.
But give me a specific. So, I looked at it, it was like, you know, that we will let the market control things a little bit more, that we will perhaps reform the way that land is owned so there isn't a difference between urban ownership and rural ownership. But I couldn't quite understand what that practically meant for a Chinese person on the street.
Sure. Let me take that last example first. The question of land ownership is vexed. At the moment in China, rural land is owned collectively, which means that local authorities are able to simply appropriate it, sell it off for urban development, and often pocket very, very large amounts for themselves. They are saying now that they're going to change that so that peasants own their own land and they have rights to that land, which means that the authorities will not be able to ride roughshod over rural communities for the sake of a quick buck. This is revolution.
Kathleen, when you follow something like this, do you think this is central government kind of, annoyed at what's happening at a regional level? Because, we see again and again these instances of people being thrown off their land, this incredible system of, it's very difficult for people to move from the rural areas to the countryside because, they have no right to enter the city. Always these rules from outside look crazy and look as though they don't kind of work. But it's never quite clear who's being blamed, whether it's, central government seems to be angered at the amount of kind of cronyism in the regions. Do you think there is a bit of a split here between region and the kind of central government?
Well, yes. I mean, central government is trying to impose central policies, but it's a big place, of course. And local political leaders are also very powerful. On the whole, they get on with what they want to do, for bad or good, until something happens, until there's a famine or until there's a huge uprising obviously a peaceful sort, until something like that happens where attention then has to be brought to that area. I mean, the thing about the farmers, which is interesting, among other things, enabling them to get some sort of money for their land, is that, for one thing, that means you can consolidate farmland in the areas. And secondly, it means that these farmers can go off to the cities, which sounds bonkers until you realize that China is also taken a decision that they have to increase consumer purchasing power as an alternative to exporting goods. And so if you can get people to the cities who have some sense of earning, you then have an economic plan that's being carried out. So it's more than just the farmers themselves. It creates, I think, to a whole economic plan.
John, there does seem to be a bit of weird wavering between whether the future kind of bullishness of the Chinese economy should be pegged on exports or homegrown consumption. Has that been kind of settled here, do you think?
I think the Chinese leadership recognises it has to be based on home consumption, that the days of very rapid export expansion are over for all kinds of reasons I won't go into here. And they want to increase consumption, not just because they want to keep the economic growth figures going, but because they want to bring more Chinese out of poverty. They want to spread the wealth outside the big coastal cities into the interior, where there is still terrible poverty. It's important to remember that for all its success, that a lot of China is desperately poor still. And they want to spread the money around. Can I just add what you were asking about some of the targets? Everybody expected this to be a purely economic document. And sure enough, all the economic reform targets are in there. They've ticked all the boxes and they've committed themselves to a very wide-ranging economic reform. What I don't think was so widely expected is that there's clear language in there for the protection of human rights in law, for the independence of the judiciary, and for military reform. Now, that wasn't discussed in advance. That simply leapt out of the plenum communique. Nobody quite yet knows what that's going to involve, but the fact that it's in a series of documents at the plenum communique is meaningful.
Just tell me bluntly, though, when we talk about human rights, when China talks about human rights, do you think we're thinking about different things? Because I saw a press conference the other day where a Chinese official was talking about human rights, and what she felt was human rights was that, you know, that the industry was growing at a pace and people would have a job. She felt that was human rights, not the individual human rights that we tend to think of.
The human rights in China are human rights as defined by the Chinese constitution, which do not go as far as the human rights that you might expect in the Western society, but the constitution goes a lot further than the current practice in China. If China simply implements its own constitution fairly and thoroughly, that would be a huge advance for human rights in China.
We're seeing also from this third plenum a suggestion that, you know, that maybe, you know, that there's a need for leadership groups to spearhead reform. Again, you were talking about the idea of, you know, China being a bit too unwieldy. Do you think that there is, whatever happens, you know, it's great to agree on all these things, but it's the implementation of these grand plans in the end that is this kind of the sticky wicket?
Well, that's always the case, but they are forming a committee to push the reforms, a committee which is meant to be above government departments. They're forming a committee, a national security committee, which is meant to be above, for example, law and justice possibly, and possibly even part of the military. So they are forming small types of committees that will have, presumably, the power to actually push the reforms which have been agreed.
And can I add to that? Yes, a committee and a target. They've got to do this by 2020, it says in the communique. By 2020, they've got to achieve wide-ranging reform in all significant areas. So they put themselves out there. They've got to be measured.
Now let's move on to North Korea. Obviously, John, an area where you have amazing expertise. But it's been suggested in the South Korean press that 80 people have been executed, perhaps for watching South Korean TV programs or potentially owning copies of the Bible. Now, we don't have huge amounts of details about this, but there are reports of people witnessing the executions taking place in sports stadia in North Korea, in seven cities, claims the South Korean paper. We find it very difficult to get any reliable information out of North Korea. But when you see a story like this, does this seem credible?
Yes, it does seem credible. And I've no reason to doubt the accuracy of the Yonhap report. The regime are clearly getting very worried about people watching foreign videos, particularly South Korean videos, and the growth of religious observance, the possession of the Bible, as you say, is particularly mentioned. I think it's important to put this in a bit of context. There have been three big stories out of North Korea in the past 48 hours. There's this one. There was the announcement by a senior North Korean official at a Chinese conference earlier today that if effectively the United States, Japan, and South Korea don't play ball, that they face nuclear catastrophe. We're back to bludgeons and threats again. The third story is one that tends to shiver down everybody's spine, that back in November last year, that Kim Jong-un may have suffered an attempt on his life. Now, you put those three together, you've got a nervous regime. You've got a guy who is in power, fine, but where he may have been, had an assassination attempt on him. He's feeling the need to repress further. You do not go out shooting people in public unless you're trying to make a very strong political statement. And what he's trying to show is that he's not going to tolerate new ideas coming in. He's trying to stop a waterfall. He can't stop this happening. And if he tries to prevent people watching South Korean videos, but DVDs, simply by shooting some of them, this is going to fail, and he must know it.
Catherine, we're almost out of time, but you know, the idea of, you know, containing a secretive state these days is almost impossible. We know that, in fact, even in North Korea, people have got hold of mobile phones. They are connected to the outside world. Do you think that the regime has any real hope of maintaining itself by isolationism?
Well, the stories that also were coming out last week are the holes, thanks to the internet, thanks to the telephone, thanks to just smuggling videos and DVDs across the border. Now, I agree that, I mean, the waterfall will be contained for a bit, but I think it's probably in the days of social media and transferable pieces of audio and video material. It's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We were going to look at what's been unfolding in Thailand as well, but we'll return to that story in another show. But John Everard and Catherine Burke, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you, London? This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come then in the second half of today's aperitivo. We're going to head to the Monocle Cafe to talk about Spain's push for sherry exports. We'll take a slow train to Switzerland and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
Survivors of the Philippines' devastating typhoon are still waiting for food, shelter and clean water. Roads and communications have been badly damaged, making it hard to reach many of them. And sanitation systems have been widely destroyed, leading aid agencies to warn of the risks of sewage contaminating water supplies. The government in Egypt has lifted a state of emergency and a curfew, which were imposed 3 months ago. Thousands of supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi have been detained by authorities since those emergency powers were brought in. But the move to end them came 2 days earlier than expected after a court ruling. China has announced a series of economic reforms which are designed to boost the country's global standing. They're promising to open access to international markets and give farmers more direct rights over their own land. But the Communist Party officials have said that state ownership will still be a key factor in the Chinese economy. India's Supreme Court set up a panel to investigate claims that a law student was sexually harassed by a recently retired judge. The woman made the claims in a blog in which she said the judge assaulted her in a hotel room in Delhi while she was working for him. And a senior UN official is criticising both government and rebel groups in Sudan, who he says are blocking efforts to vaccinate 165,000 children against polio. The country has been free of the disease for the last 2 years, but officials are worried there could be an outbreak in two southern states. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. And Paul sneaking off, I'm not sure whether to have a sherry, but I should tell you more about that in a moment, because welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. The time is currently 21.33 in Moscow, and it's 18.33 here in London, which means it's 14.33 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on nearby Chiltern Street. We normally go there for coffee and conversation, but on today's show, we meet Tim Luther, co-founder of the new London Sherry Tavern, Drake's Tobanco, which just opened in October.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And yes, you do indeed find me in the Monocle Cafe, where I'm delighted to say I am indeed joined by Tim Luther. Tim, welcome to the programme. Thanks for coming to chat with us today.
Pleasure. Yeah, nice to be here.
Let me just start by asking you. I guess I wanted to start by asking you about sherry, actually, before we talk about the restaurant specifically. Talk to me a little bit about your sort of love and appreciation of sherry. Do you think it is still an underappreciated beverage, an underappreciated culinary and drinking resource, particularly here in the UK?
Yeah, very much so. Completely underappreciated. I mean, I got to know sherry because I used to work for a wine company. We specialised in importing Spanish wine, and I was lucky enough to go on several trips to Spain, visit the wineries, and get a flavour for all things Spanish. Yeah, so it was there where I tried sherry for the first time, and probably like a lot of people, wasn't convinced on my first sip, but it soon, after a couple of tries, soon became apparent to me that I'd been missing out on something pretty special.
Do you think it's sort of ripe now to actually make the breakthrough? Do you think this time can be different?
Yeah, I mean, it's still got a long way to go, but I think there's a neighbourhood restaurant in Clapham, not far from where I live. They've got two or three sherries on their list. I think 5 years ago, that just wouldn't, you know, have happened. But I think it was, yeah, still, sadly, very much seen as a drink for your granny, for your great aunt, for the vicar's tipple, you know, yeah, dons at Oxford and Cambridge. I think, you know, and the real excitement in the restaurant scene here in London is really helping sherry, because sherry is something that really is best with food and so many different types of food, not just Spanish food. Why does sherry just have to be drunk with sardines, you know, or anchovies, which is seen as very much a Spanish thing? Why can't it be enjoyed with, you know, salmon gravlax, for example, which is something we have on our menu? But yeah, I think I do really believe it's we're on the verge of seeing it in a lot more places.
Let's talk then about the potential robustness of this your latest venture. I've been lucky enough to go there myself, so I can certainly attest to the quality of the menu. Tell me how you go about actually sort of building the menu. You've got the kind of the broad concept, I guess, but once you came to sort of finessing it, honing it, in terms of also, you know, the selection of sherries, once you've decided that's where you want to go, how do you work on that? How do you decide, you know, how much is enough? Do you, you know, have, I think, five or six sherries there. Do you sort of go for quality control? Do you think, oh, actually we should build that list and maybe have a dozen or 20? Or how do you work out sort of where to draw those lines when you're putting it all together?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, good question. With Drake's Tobacco, we were very much after quality over quantity. We felt that to give sherry its best chance of success, we have to have the best stuff, sell it for a, you know, decent price. So we teamed up, so to speak, with Fernanda de Castilla, who are a boutique winery in Jerez, and we get all our sherries from them. And some people may think, you know, that's slightly limiting, but when you find the best stuff, then, you know, you have all the choice that you need in that one, and we have it all in that one producer. And what's, again, very different about Drake's Tobacco is that our oxidized styles are in barrel, and that's the first time that's been done over here. And the whole point of that is taking something out of the winery in its rawest form. So this, the wine that we have in barrel is not filtered or stabilized. So it's what you call en rama, which means raw effectively. So all that goodness that you kind of lose when you put it through filtering and cold stabilization, you're not losing because you're not doing that process. So you are getting effectively the product that you would be trying in the winery on Windmill Street, which is, yeah, great.
We've seen a real sort of growth in the interest in kind of Spanish style of dining, if you like, tapas restaurants, pinchos, these kinds of experiences. As you say, it's interesting there to capture that sort of authentic taste, literally in the case of bringing over some, you know, new concepts like keeping things in the barrel instead. Do you think there is ever a risk, though, that people will say, well, there's too many sort of authentic, in inverted commas, tapas places, and that you can sort of run that risk of almost drifting into this sort of slightly kind of the ersatz realism? How do you sort of walk that line? Is that something you're worried about, or do you think as long as you keep doing, you know, great food and good drink, you actually don't have too much to worry about?
Yeah, I think so. You're right, though, that, you know, it's something to bear in mind. I mean, at Drake's, we have a Spanish-British menu with a twist, if you like. We were conscious of not being another tapas bar. Not that there's anything wrong if it's a good tapas bar, you know, I'm all for it. And again, we want people to be thinking about sherry slightly outside the box. It doesn't need to be something with a small plate with a tapas. It can be with a full plate of food. Yeah, and the, you know, the mix between the British and the Spanish seemed like a very obvious thing to do. Sherry, in a way, is half British, half Spanish with the history. Our name, Drake's, Tabanco is Drake after Sir Francis Drake, and then Tabanco is a Spanish word. So yeah, it just seemed like a logical thing. And as I say, we want to sort of break down stereotypes and get sherry to be really appreciated. I really hope sherry is here to stay and to grow. So we do have plans to have a handful of Drake's. Certainly, to start with, I think it is fairly London-centric in terms of the UK. But, you know, you mentioned the university dons. We are considering Cambridge, Oxford. I mean, that might be a good place. I haven't looked into it in too much detail yet, but I think certainly at the moment, London is the focus. And if the right partner abroad, you know, you always talk about London restaurant scene and almost in the same breath, New York, two of the most exciting places in the world for food, for restaurants. So who knows? Yeah, onwards and upwards.
Well, so if the listeners are listening in today, they know who to get in touch with. Tim Luther, thanks for coming to speak to us about it. And the best of luck with Drake's Tabanco, which, current culinary fans in London can find on Wilmore Street in Fitzrovia, right here in London. Tim, thanks very much for joining us. With that, Andrew, it's back to you in the studio.
Thanks very much, Tom. That was Tom, make mine a large one, Edwards, with Tim Luther, co-founder of the new London Sherry Tavern, Drake's Tabanco. Up next, pull on your crinolines, because we're heading off to Switzerland, Victorian style. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. In 1863, a visionary travel agent named Thomas Cook took a group of British tourists on the first package holiday to Switzerland. Jemima Morell, one of the young women who embarked on the trip, kept a diary. And that meant that 150 years later, English émigré Dickon Bewes was able to follow in her footsteps. In Slow Train to Switzerland, Bewes tells the story of those early tourists travelling through Europe and reflects on how the Alpine nation has changed since then. Bewes paid a visit to Midori House to discuss his book with me just a bit earlier, and I began by asking him how this book charts the beginning of tourism.
Well, what was interesting for me is that Thomas Cook in 1863 was already quite well known in Britain because of his tours to the Great Exhibition and his trips to Scotland, but he hadn't ever succeeded enticing the British off their island. And the difference that Switzerland made was that for the first time he had a successful tour abroad, and it became so successful so quickly that he added more and more tours, and the following year added Italy and then Egypt and then India. And so it became this sort of snowball of tourism abroad, people taking holidays abroad for the first time. And everything we associate with modern tourism roughly dates back to that Swiss tour, because as a result of the success, he invented traveler's checks, he invented hotel vouchers, he created modern tourism as we know it.
Now, why was the time ripe then for tourism to take off?
Partly because Britain then was the richest country in the world. It had had the Industrial Revolution for, let's say, 30 years. And so it had this new middle class, which had time and money to consider going on a holiday. Up until then, to go to Switzerland, you had to be quite rich. It took 2 weeks to get there. You stayed for a couple of months, and then you came back in your coach and horses. And so Lord Byron, for instance, went for 3 months and stayed beside Lake Geneva, and it's where Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein and all that sort of stuff. No one who was a doctor or a lawyer and only had 3 weeks off a year could contemplate going to Switzerland. What changed was Thomas Cook made use of the trains, which meant 2 days to Switzerland instead of 2 weeks, and negotiated group tickets, which reduced the cost to something that a middle-class banker in Yorkshire could afford. The reason why he chose Switzerland was because just at that point, the romantic writers, painters, poets had created this ideal of this wonderful landscape with waterfalls and mountains and meadows, the great antidote to the smoggy, dirty cities of industrial Britain. And so Switzerland and the Alps were no longer this barrier in the middle of Europe to stop you getting to Italy. They became a destination in their own right.
Now, on that first trip, there's a young lady, 31 years old, called Jemima Morrell, who becomes the heroine of your tale. And I think you amazingly say that there was, I think, some 100-odd people went off when they set off from Britain. But by the time they came to the end of the tour, there was only 7 of them who had been kind of strong enough to kind of make it to the end. We kind of think of Switzerland as being just around the corner these days. But it was a huge adventure for them. Could you just tell us about Jemima Morrell?
Well, originally, she was from Selby in Yorkshire. She was unmarried. She still lived with her parents, as unmarried women did in those days. She didn't have a job as such. She was an artist. And she had travelled a bit. She says in her diary, "We've been to Scotland, we've been to the Lake District, and we're kind of bored of Britain. Let's go somewhere else." And they go to Switzerland. And it was an adventure. It was quite intrepid. It wasn't rafting down the Amazon, but the trains finished at Geneva. And so after that, they had to walk, they had to go ride by donkey, they had to take coaches, they had to take steamboats, and they didn't really know where they were going. It wasn't planned like a package tour is planned today. They had tickets there, and they roughly knew they wanted to see the Eiger and to see Lucerne. And in between, they hadn't booked any hotels. They walked over mountain passes 25 miles a day in their big crinoline dresses and corsets. They didn't change clothes for a week. There were no toilets on the trains. It wasn't luxury travel. It was really an extreme interrail tour. And there's one reason we know all this is because Miss Jemima wrote a diary. And Thomas Cook, in fact, has one short report about the tour, and that's it. And it would have been just yet another tour in his many tours at that time. Without Miss Jemima's diary, we have day-to-day detail of what they did, what she was thinking, what they saw, what they ate. So it's a great piece of social history.
And extraordinarily, this diary, there's a bit of a mystery about it, how it survives. But it's found after the bombing of a building in the East End of London in a kind of a box. It's been saved.
Yes, exactly.
It has its own adventures, the diary as well.
Yes, she wrote it for her and her friends. She was travelling with her brother and 5 friends. And obviously she made notes because the diary itself, it's in the Thomas Cook archives. It's written beautifully in longhand and it has her illustrations. And so I think she probably wrote it afterwards because there's no crossings out. There's no blotchy ink. But no one knew anything about it. It basically disappeared for 80 years, then turned up in a blitzed warehouse in the East End of London. No one knows how it got there 80 years later. But it was very clearly an account of the first Thomas Cook tour of Switzerland. The only published edition was for the centenary in 1963, which is the edition I found online when I was researching Swiss history. And so I thought, well, it'd be a jolly wheeze to follow in the footsteps of this lady. Not being a lady myself, I didn't wear the crinoline and I didn't ride on a donkey. I don't think you can do that anymore in Switzerland. But I followed the route exactly. So stayed in the same places they stayed and tried to do what they did each day.
Now, the other amazing thing is when you hear about Switzerland, you know, in our imagination today, it's a place of, you know, cleanliness, of efficiency, of great wealth, of, you know, certainly no poor people allowed these days in Switzerland, it seems. But certainly when you read this book, you know, this was a very rural place, dirt poor, many people living in proper poverty. Yeah. And, you know, as Jemima wanders around, she's slightly shocked by the natives.
Yes, and this is from someone who's probably used to urban beggars in Britain. This was the time of Oliver Twist. Britain was also had its pockets of poverty. But in Switzerland, it was something completely different. It was a bit like those pictures you see of George Clooney when he was at high school. It's before Switzerland was famous. And it was very poor. It didn't have milk chocolate. That didn't come until 12 years later. It didn't have Heidi. It didn't have Swiss Army knives. None of those cliches about Switzerland existed then. Switzerland was quite a rural economy. Life expectancy was only 40 years. And the people lived scratching a living off the ground, essentially. The guidebook that Mr. Mima uses recommends for all tourists, as soon as they leave the hotel, to always have a few small coins in their pockets to get rid of the armies of beggars that beset the rich British tourists as they leave the hotel every day. So it's a very different picture of Switzerland from the one we know.
And well, I don't want to give away the end of the book, because that would really spoil it. But it's fair to say the end turns out to be a bit of a mystery, or a more modern mystery attached to the book as well.
Gosh, how do I say that without giving away the end?
Let's not spoil the end, because I think that people, you know, Slow Train to Switzerland is a great book and people need to buy it. So let's not give the game away. But let's just say there is a bit of an intrigue at the end, isn't there?
There is a personal connection that I didn't expect when I started either researching or travelling or writing the book. And it was a complete surprise to me. But I think it makes a great ending to the book and a great ending for me after years of working on it.
Well, that was my chat with the author Dickon Buse on his latest book, Slow Train to Switzerland. Now, how about this for a link? So, well, Jemima Morrell went in 1863 to Switzerland, and we've found a track called 1983 by Sophie Hunger, who's Swiss from Zurich. Let's play it. Well, that was Sophie Hunger, and she's in fact a diplomat's daughter, so quite relevant for this show as well. And that was her track, 1983.
From London
to Zurich
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Beijing
to Sao Paulo
noch Amsterdam
a Bogota,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before we do, let's see what's coming up on tonight's programmes. I'm joined in the studio now by Andrew Muller and Barbara Feeney. Andrew, what are you running tonight? You're in charge of Globalist Asia, is that correct?
I'm not by any means in charge. I'm merely presenting it.
You're in the hot seat. You're taking over this very chair, I believe.
Exactly that chair. We have, as ever, a bunch of stuff. We're leading with it's a story that's not really hooked to a news item. It's sort of a confluence of straws in the wind,
if
you will.
It's not something you've made up, is it?
It is not something we've made up, or at least it may be something the producers made up. I'm just following orders. No, but the idea is considering whether Saudi Arabia's influence in the world is ebbing. Things have recently been in one way or another turning against it, and it could very well be argued not before time. But if you look at things happening like America becoming increasingly self-sufficient in oil, its lack of diplomatic clout has been made apparent by its inability really to organize the civil war in Syria to its own preferences, by the fact that its nemesis Iran is talking to the rest of the world, and at home it has been the stuff of comedy routines, because it does seem very quaint that we're still talking about this in 2013. But the idea that women in Saudi Arabia actually want to drive cars and things, this sort of thing could become significant. It may have to reconsider how it does business.
It was interesting. We were talking about the Iran story earlier on in the show, and does seem to be a real moment, doesn't there, that, you know, the Americans are going to lose some friends if they make a deal with Iran, and one of those friends quite likely will be Saudi, who are not going to be happy, even if Iran is legitimately giving up its nuclear potential for creating arms. They're not going to be happy.
It is an incredibly difficult balancing act for the United States, because any rapprochement with Iran, they lose friends everywhere in the Middle East. There is no love for Iran anywhere in Arabia. It's a tricky one.
Well, a very hard country to read, so it'd be fascinating to hear that. And Barbara, what are you leading with tonight?
So, Andrew, we are starting off in Egypt. There's a couple of things out of Egypt today. There's a report that says Egypt is the worst Arab state for women. So we're going to explore that. We're going to have Rachel Shabby in studio with us, and we're also going to be speaking to Abdulrahman Hussein in Cairo. And there's a few other things in Egypt today as well. The state of emergency has been lifted, and also the curfew after 3 months. So there's a couple of things.
Well, it's extraordinary. We've seen this happen, you know, in Iraq. We've seen it actually happen in Syria. We've seen it happen in Egypt. There may be some kind of like political change, but it's often not very good for women, you know,
exactly.
Women who don't want to wear the headscarf, who don't want to wear the veil, who had jobs. They often find that all of those are swept away in these revolutions as well.
And that's what this report is saying, that they thought it would be quite beneficial for women, the Arab Spring, but it's actually been to their detriment. There's been, you know, more violence and they've been oppressed more. So it's not particularly good news.
Because, Andrew, very quickly, I know that you went to Alexandria long before the revolution for Monocle magazine, and you covered there quite open society that's been swept away now.
Alexandria was on the verge of being swept away at that point, even before the Arab Spring, but that does seem to have accelerated the process, yes.
Well, thank you both. Two good shows coming out. That's The Globalist Asia and The Daily. Both are happening tonight. But that's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Everard and Kathleen Burke. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and it was researched by Alexa Firmanich and Matt Alagaya. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Next, after the headlines, is Section D, where we head to Turin to assess its burgeoning design scene.
You realise that the city and its citizens have always been busy working, innovating and creating to the highest of standards. It just isn't in the Torinese's nature to brag about it.
And remember, this is the final week of Season 1 of Aperitivo, but we'll be back in the new year for Season 2 with more great guests, stories and reports from around the world. But until then, this show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. And I've got a feeling I'm in the hot seat again. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thank you for listening.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.